Hello, and welcome to today's OJJDP UD ETC audio teleconference program. This is Aidan Moore of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation in Calverton, Maryland, and I'm a senior program manager with the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center. This program is part of the continuing series of audio teleconference presentations produced by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation in cooperation with the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in support of the Enforcing Underage Drinking Law Program. Before we begin today's call, I'd like to remind you, as did Nicole, our operator, that you will be the program will be recorded and will be available to you for later listening and download. During the presentations from our guests, you, the audience, will be in listen mode only. Today's call promises to convey some interesting information as we explore the fast-moving area of alcohol product development and public health and policy implications associated with release of these new product lines. We will invite our listeners to ask questions of our panel approximately halfway into our program, so we ask you to formulate your questions early on. Nicole, can you provide our participants and our audience with instructions on how they can pose questions to our presenters?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question over the phone, you may do so by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Please remember, if you're using a speakerphone, to disable that function before pressing star 1.
Thank you, Nicole. And following today's call, registrants will receive an email asking your assessment of today's presentation. We ask that you respond to the email at your earliest convenience, and we'd like to thank you in advance for your feedback. For those of you who have computers with Internet access, you can follow our presentation at, I hope you have a pencil for this, https://pyre.ilink.com/join/people/people/c/charlie/m/mary/h/henry/y/young/people. I will try to explain that later, but please, that is the way to log in. And note, if you're using a dial-up connection to the Internet, you may experience a delay in slides appearing on your screen. On the computer, there's a chat feature on the web presentations where participants can ask questions and make comments. Please note that PIRE monitors but does not moderate this chat box. We're not discouraging from using this feature. However, we cannot assure you that the information you receive through the chat box is the most up-to-date or even correct. We'd also like to note that the views of today's presenters are not necessarily the views of OJJDP or the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. If you have questions about the materials presented today that are not answered in the moderated question and answer session, please email me at amoore@pyre.org, and I'll be happy to contact our presenters and try to respond to you in a timely manner. Today's call is entitled Alcohol Energy Drinks. They Pack a Killer Punch. While underage drinking is not merely a harmless rite of passage, as some would claim, but rather a serious public health and safety issue requiring the engagement of the entire community to resolve. As you can see in this slide, underage alcohol use and abuse produces a level of harm far greater than many people comprehend. Alcohol plays a significant role in the level of harm we experience in our communities. While underage alcohol consumption is unlawful, the way in which alcohol is often consumed and the influencing factors that support excessive alcohol consumption often lead to harm. In recent years, we have borne witness to the evolution and trends associated with alcohol marketing and product development. The introduction of wine coolers in the 1980s introduced the public to a sweet-tasting alcohol product. From there, the race to get pre-mixed alcohol products to market was on and became an industry-wide effort, bringing the malt beverage and spirits industries into a product development race. In recent years, and in response to what the industry has described as consumer demands, the scope of products continue to evolve and, in some cases, produce products that have an unsafe result. Today, our distinguished panel will provide their insight and perspective on the policy, medical, and industry issues swirling around this area and assess the impact of aggressive marketing and product development trends employed by some segments of the alcohol industry, as well as future issues that we can expect to see. So let me introduce our panel. Our first panelist is attorney Michelle Simon. Michelle is a public health lawyer specializing in policy analysis, legal strategies, and countering corporate tactics. With 14 years of experience researching and writing about the food industry, Ms. Simon is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. She is currently watchdogging the alcohol industry as Marin Institute's research and policy director. Ms. Simon is a regular speaker on both the food and alcohol policy at various national and international conferences. Ms. Simon has taught alcohol policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and health policy at the University of California, Hastings College of Law, where she also received her law degree. And she holds a master's degree in public health from Yale University. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Our next presenter is Diane Reby. And since the organization's beginning in 1995, Diane Reby has led Project Extra Mile and its statewide network of coalitions to prevent underage drinking and youth access to alcohol. Her experience includes successfully guiding alcohol policy efforts at the local and state level, including testifying and working closely with policymakers and their staff, coordinating coalition support of heightened enforcement, planning media, advocacy strategies, and engaging youth leaders. Diane serves as a national consultant and trainer for the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. She provides training and technical assistance across the country on policy and media advocacy, environmental strategies, community and enforcement partnerships, and the coalition building to prevent underage drinking. Diane also served on the National Board of Directors for the Mothers Against Drunk Driving as President of Public Policy, as Vice President of Public Policy. A graduate of the College of St. Mary in Nebraska, Diane holds a bachelor's degree in business leadership. Welcome to you, Diane.
Thank you.
Our third presenter is Mr. Steve Schmidt, and he's the Vice President of Public Policy and Communications for the National Alcohol Beverage Control Association, also known as NABCA. Presently, he is overseeing the research and development of policy, best practices, and communication strategies to assist states manage control and regulatory systems and prevent alcohol-related harm. Previously, he was the director of alcohol education for the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, where he was responsible for the vision and development of statewide initiatives to reduce underage drinking and high-risk college drinking, the creation of innovative education programming for local communities, the establishment of grant programs that funded colleges and community prevention efforts, and a comprehensive, responsible alcohol management program. Steve has consulted with state and national organizations, authored several articles, and presented at numerous national and state conferences on a variety of alcohol-related issues. He has been professionally employed for over 31 years in positions responsible for addressing alcohol-related issues at local, state, and national levels. And welcome to you, Steve.
Thank you.
And we greatly appreciate all of you for taking your time and joining us today. So as we begin our presentation, we'll begin by asking Michelle Simon to provide us with a bit of historical perspective on our topic and help set the stage for our program. Michelle, times have changed as well as some drinking habits and the types of products available in the marketplace. Can you help trace for our audience how we got to this place in time and some of your observations?
Sure. Well, my historical reference goes back really as far as my time with Marin Institute, which is 2007. But I think what I'd like to do is give you kind of a brief timeline of what happened with this topic. And I also think, excuse me, it's important to realize that, you know, these caffeinated alcopops, which is really what they are, kind of grew out of a number of other beverage categories. First, we had the sweetened alcoholic beverages, which we refer to as alcopops, and we've been fighting those for years. And then parallel to that, in the soft drink world, we had obviously just regular soft drinks, and then this trend that really came on in the 1990s of highly caffeinated soft drinks or so-called energy drinks. So this was a trend that was really promoted by Red Bull, and then other companies kind of jumped on that bandwagon, and these highly caffeinated soft drinks became very popular with teenagers, and the alcohol beverage industry took a look at that and thought, wow, that looks like a good idea. Why don't we have something like that? And so that's how we got to this idea of combining caffeine and alcohol. And then the way that it came to Marin Institute's attention was actually in 2007, when we were part of really a national campaign to take on this crazy product that Anheuser-Busch put out back then called Spikes. Everyone remembers they were these little kind of 2-ounce bottles, look like kids' nail polish, and they came in different colors and flavors. And they also happened to contain, they were alcoholic, but they also contained caffeine and some other stimulants. The most crazy thing about them was their size and how kid-friendly they obviously were. So we joined with other groups and actually a number of state attorneys general, and we'll talk a lot more about their role, but in, you know, a media campaign against these products. And, you know, the media loves this sort of thing. I mean, it's so obvious that these products are over the top and Anheuser-Busch had gone too far. So we won that one pretty easily, I would say, within a matter of weeks to months of, you know, there being media attention, and Anheuser-Busch backed down and took those products off the market. But that, I think, was kind of the kickoff to this idea, well, wait a minute, what was caffeine doing in alcohol anyway? I mean, there were other problems with these products, but that was kind of the beginning. And then realizing there were other products on the market, much more dangerous, really, than even those little products, Marin Institute decided we needed to take a closer look at this trend of combining caffeine and alcohol, because no one had really done that. And so we put out this report. I co-authored it with Jim Mosier, who really was the first person to bring this to my attention. He did that when I first started in 2007, and we released our report in summer of 2007, which was the first time anyone had really taken a look at how this got started, which were the specific brands that were on the market, how were they being marketed, particularly to young people, and what did we know about the potential health impacts. And at that time, we knew very little. There wasn't much in the way of research being done. We knew from common sense it wasn't a very good idea, of course, to combine caffeine with alcohol. But the science was, you know, there just wasn't that much. So we put out this report and showing things like, you know, how easy it was to confuse the soft drink versions with the alcoholic versions, showing images of them, showing how they were being marketed to young people through viral marketing, specifically naming brands, et cetera. And the report got a lot of interest. I mean, from, you know, activists all over the country, and I wound up doing a number of presentations at various conferences about it and so forth. And then in the wake of that report, Jim and I got contacted by Mary Claire O'Brien, a doctor at Wake Forest University, who had the experience of a college student showing up in her emergency room having consumed caffeine and alcohol. That got her very interested in the topic, and she wound up doing some research on it. She's really been the premier researcher on this issue and became a very key player. And just, you know, to back up for a moment, the picture I want to paint here is that there were a number of aspects of this campaign or, you know, 4-year history that really came together to get to the victory that we got last November with FDA. And it's important to kind of recognize each picture, each piece of the puzzle, to paint the full picture of how we got this really important public health victory. So Mary Claire O'Brien's research was tremendously important in showing what we knew from common sense, namely that young people who combined caffeine and alcohol were more likely to get into trouble in a number of ways. They were more likely to get injured. They were more likely to engage in risky behavior. They were more likely to injure others. A number of ways that she showed there was this increased risk from combining alcohol with caffeine, and that was both from combining them separately, so taking, say, Red Bull, combining it with vodka, as well as consuming the premixed beverages. And so So along the way, there's a number of state attorneys general, and there's a committee of state attorneys general who have been concerned with youth alcohol consumption for some time, and they got particularly interested in this emerging product line of caffeine and alcohol. And so they started investigating the two largest companies that were making these products at the time. This is back in 2007, 2008. And those were Anheuser-Busch, who was making the product Tilt, and for a while they were also making a beer variety that had caffeine. The most popular product on the market at that time was called Sparks, and that was a product by MillerCoors. And the Attorney General operate sort of in secret. And so we knew that there was an investigation going on because they had sent public letters to the company sort of warning them, and we knew that behind the scenes there were investigations going on. But, you know, we weren't privy to knowing the details or how soon there might be a resolution. And so during this time there was additional campaigning and media attention and so forth. And then in June of 2008, the Attorneys General, a number of them, reached agreement with Anheuser-Busch. That company agreed to stop making its products, its alcoholic beverages containing caffeine, and not making any similar products in the future. MillerCoors took a bit longer to come around to the same agreement. They did so in December of 2008. So later, at the end of that year, we had MillerCoors agreeing to this. And this is really important to understand because at least Anheuser-Busch likes to spin this as they're having done this sort of out of the goodness of their hearts, you know, that they voluntarily, they've actually used this terminology in, you know, recent times with the FDA investigation. They say, oh, weren't we so great because we voluntarily agreed to stop. You know, they volunteered with the threat of a lawsuit hanging down their necks from the Attorneys General. And so, you know, I can't emphasize enough the importance of working with your state AG's office. Of course, hopefully they're a friendly office. They aren't all. We happen to be lucky. We have a number of them who were very aggressive on this topic. And so the AGs basically got Anheuser-Busch and MillerCoors to stop making their products. And this was a huge victory, especially getting Sparks off the market, because we knew that that was the most popular product. However, the story doesn't end there because, of course, those were just two companies. They were the two largest companies making the most popular products. But, you know, the marketplace, such that it is, when certain brands go away, other companies sort of swoop in to fill the void, and that's exactly what happened. And so within, I would say, maybe a period of months, we started seeing new products pop up, and they were obviously not made by these two big companies. They were independent companies. In some cases, it looked like brand-new companies being formed for the sole purpose of making these outrageous products. And we quickly realized that we had probably two new enemies on our hands. One, a company called Fusion Project, which makes a line called Four Loko, which we've heard a lot about. And then the other company called United Brands, which makes the line of juice products. And these products got even, if it was possible to get to be worse than before, they found a way, and that was by making them even in larger size containers. So back in the days of Sparks, it was only a mere 16 ounces, although Sparks was getting into high levels of alcohol, so into 10, and I think at one point they were going to make a 12% alcohol product. But Juice and Four Loko were making up to 12% alcohol products in 24-ounce cans. So we had an even bigger problem on our hands with these products. And so along the way, you know, Marina Stu continued to campaign about this issue, and I should say we were always calling for states to take action. And I know Steve's going to talk more about that, but we were very clear that states certainly had the right under the 21st Amendment to ban the products outright, either through their state legislature or, if possible and appropriate, through their state ABC or regulatory body. And so that was something we continued to campaign on. We developed model legislation, and we also had our own bill here in California that we were pushing for. So, you know, all these things are kind of happening in parallel, right? And when our report from Marina Stu came out in 2007, one of the issues that we highlighted was this problem of caffeine not being an approved additive by FDA. With some legal research that Jim and I figured out needed to be looked at. And so we were very pleased when the FDA took up the issue. And again, have to give credit where credit is due. The team of Attorneys General were really came down to a handful of key people who were pushing the FDA to take this on. And so the announcement was made in November 2009 that indeed FDA was launching an investigation into basically whether caffeine is indeed a safe additive in alcoholic beverages. And that's when they sent notices to 30 some of companies that made products, alcoholic beverages combined with caffeine, basically demanding that these companies show that their products were safe. And this was, you know, a pretty huge, bold move by FDA. They said they were giving the companies 30 days, which, of course, turned out to stretch into a year. But, you know, they wanted to give companies an opportunity to respond, and so they gave them plenty of time to do so. And, you know, we understand that companies asked for more time, and we couldn't figure out what the companies could possibly be providing in the way of safety information. But anyway, so months passed. We were at this point getting very frustrated because we thought, well, you know, clearly there's not going to be any evidence of safety, and FDA is just going to say what we've known all along, that caffeine is an unsafe additive in alcohol. And then, unfortunately, it took a lot of bad press that I'm sure many are familiar with. It started coming out, I think, last fall, where there were two particularly bad incidents, one out of Washington State and one in New Jersey, where college students, a number of them, wound up in the emergency room reportedly having drank Four Loko. And so this caused a whole new round of media firestorm about these beverages, particularly Four Loko. And I think it was that pressure that finally brought to bear. I mean, obviously FDA was finalizing its decision-making. Pressure was already being brought, or continuing to be brought by the Attorney General. Senator Schumer's office from New York got involved and was really pushing FDA, and both and FTC, and I should say the Federal Trade Commission also was involved and ruled as well at the same time that FDA did. So the upshot was last November when FDA finally, a year later, did what we knew they needed to do, which is basically say caffeine is not is an illegal additive in alcoholic beverages, and sent notices to four companies making seven different products. And there was some confusion about that. And the way I understand it is those products were the ones that FDA could physically find on the market, and so that's why they chose to focus on those products. And but as far as they're concerned, there should be no products on the market that contain that are alcoholic, that contain caffeine. And if there are any other products, they would go after those too. We're saying we need to take care of this problem once and for all still by having states finish the deal by just outlawing the practice altogether of combining caffeine and alcohol. So finally finished up and then I'll stop talking. Of course, the other problem we still have in our hands is these what we call supersized alcohol pops. So the two main companies that we were concerned about, Four Loko, or the Four Loko brand and the juice brands, wound up reformulating their beverages in the wake of the FDA notification so that their products still exist, unlike, well, actually the other products still exist too, but the products still exist without caffeine, but they remain in these insanely high high alcohol percentage, huge containers. And so we still have a problem with these. Well, we've always had a problem with alcohol products, but now they're coming in even larger containers with higher percent alcohol. So that's where we're taking our campaign next. And you know, I've been talking for a long time. So that sort of what brings us to where we are now. And I think I'll just stop there.
Well, Michelle, thank you for starting us off with some great perspective. And I think your explanation was very important for our audience to kind of get a complete picture of how this issue kind of came to where it is today. And thank you for all your efforts on this, as you've kind of worked on this for quite a time. And we'd like to remind those of us who have joined us late in our program, today's audio topic is alcohol energy drinks. They pack a killer punch. So we would like to now transition to our next presenter, Diane Reby, who represents Project Extra Mile, in Nebraska. And recently, Project Extra Mile and the citizens of Nebraska enjoyed their day in Lancaster District Court. So, Diane, welcome, and thank you for joining our conversation on this most important topic. And what happened in Lancaster District Court?
Well, I'll share that with you in a minute, Aiden. That's it's a really good transition. And, Michelle, I just want to thank you for giving a great overview, because it plays and works right into where I hope to take kind of the conversation. I'd like to start just by, for those who may not know us, letting you know that we're a very comprehensive organization, a statewide network of coalitions in 11 counties across Nebraska, which really covers more than 50% of the state's population, looking at underage drinking and youth access to alcohol. But I wanted you to see that up front so that you know, as I kind of go into these very specific issues in terms of the organizing, that it's much larger than this, and our efforts are much more comprehensive, but we're going to focus in a very somewhat narrow area. When we look at, for next slide, when we look at the alcoholic energy drinks issue, and I did appreciate Michelle's overview, because she reminded me of, as we look at spikes, and then there, of course, after spikes was zippers, we've been involved in this issue of products and the kind of harm they have in our communities really since we began to see those out. And I'd really kind of, frankly, Michelle, forgotten a little bit about those products and forgotten about the threatening phone calls from the owners of one of those products, because we are so, I guess one would say, certainly assertive in our discussion within the community to make certain that the community is having the discussion. First and foremost, we see this issue and these products as a public health issue, and I think that's relevant and important for us all to focus on, that it's more than just a piece of this issue. It's very critical in this larger public health issue. And Michelle, again, referred to them as either binge or blackout in a can, and they are the supersized alcohol pops. We saw and continue to see the critical connection between what we see as the alcoholic energy drinks really being the second generation alcohol pops. And so there's really not a way in our world to disconnect alcohol pops and alcoholic energy drinks from what we see as that larger relevant alcohol policy discussion. Next slide. When we look at it, and we're going to say 2008, but again, as I mentioned briefly, it really was before that time, just some of the concrete pieces and steps that we took, we created a one-sheeter or a fact sheet, as you would think of it, to educate our coalitions and our youth groups. Again, to make sure that we were creating and engaging the community, creating a community discussion and having that engagement by our community partners, really being the source for them of a good deal of the information that they were getting. We also think as we put out information, it's extremely important for us to scrub that information clean to make certain that we have certainly attributed the information and the research where it appropriately is to be. So it's not simply Project Extra Mile putting out information. We sent a letter very early to our Attorney General to encourage his involvement with the group of attorneys generals who were actually working on the issue of the alcoholic energy drinks. We met then with our Attorney General to yet again encourage him. We actually sent him two letters and then encouraged him in person to be involved in that larger issue, seeing it from our vantage point as relevant, not just relevant to those of us in the public health and safety and prevention field, but also to the attorneys generals and to the state from a larger vantage point. Michelle mentioned that some of the attorney generals are aggressive. We have an aggressive attorney general. He's just not aggressive in the way we want him to be, and you'll see that here shortly. We then went out and went on to send a news release on the reformulation of SPARC, again, ramping up the community discussion on what was happening across the nation because it was relevant in our own local communities. We also sent a letter of thanks to Senator Schumer. We sometimes think we're a sister state to New York, but we wanted to thank him from a national leadership perspective that he understood that people across the country were paying attention to the work that he was doing and the voice he was bringing to the issue. We go on, and then next slide, please. We had to revise that one-sheeter when we saw the reformulation of SPARC and then the introduction of Juice and 4 Local, because, again, this was a new landscape. We had, you know, the market being filled with products that no one really could have anticipated. We should probably stop saying that because we should anticipate almost anything at this point. We, throughout this process, continued to have a conversation with our state ABC, our Liquor Control Commission. We felt like and still do throughout this process with all of these issues to have early and ongoing discussions with our regulatory agency. Even though we may be on the different side of the issues oftentimes, it's still critical that we have that communication and have those discussions, firmly believing that we can do that with respect and we can do that professionally, and that's really our job in the field. When the FDA and others came out with their decision and those discussions that were moving, we urged the Liquor Control Commission, as Michelle indicated, at the local level, to pull those products immediately. And that was a pretty aggressive kind of ongoing communication, mostly private, to really have our Liquor Control Commission understand that there was a community input out there that was really urging them to do the right thing, all the time having the pressure knowing that the FDA decision was coming shortly. At the same time, having our coalitions across the state focusing on those issues with very clear kind of timelines and at the same time so that it was a very coordinated kind of discussion. Early then in December, our commission did vote to ban those products in the state. Next slide, please. Next slide again. Then we'll take you on and look at the transition from the alcoholic energy drinks, although really it was the other way around, Alka-Pops into the alcoholic energy drinks. We started on the issue of Alka-Pops in October of 2003 with our Liquor Control Commission. That seems like light years away, not quite, but almost. And at that time, our commission, our regulatory body, sent a letter to all of the wholesalers and retailers in our state and said very clearly in that letter that Alka-Pops under Nebraska statute are defined as distilled spirits. And that is important to know and relevant to know that the chairman of our commission at that time is the same gentleman who's chairman currently. So it was not a wholesale turnover of that commission. It was a wholesale change in their position, and it actually was much quicker than years. The following month, we saw the alcohol industry attending the commission hearings to urge a delay of their decision. The commission had indicated that beginning January 1 of 2004, those products would be taxed and regulated as distilled spirits in our state. The industry came in full force, and I mean that literally and figuratively. One could barely get into the hearing room. It was jam-packed, standing room only with industry people and perhaps three of us. So a very small turnout on our end because very early it was difficult to have the field understand the relevance of this issue. Again, important to note that Nebraska law says that any product in our state containing any, and the word used is any alcohol obtained by the distillation process, shall be determined as a distilled spirit. And in our state, the product is classified in the manner in which it is produced, so how it's created. Next slide. Of course, you may remember that in January of 2005, the Tax and Trade Bureau adopted its final ruling saying that a product can have as much as 49% distilled spirits and still be considered a beer. We then had, during that same time period, a legislative proposal introduced to flip Nebraska's law to essentially take what was, by everyone's standard, a pretty solid law, using that word any, and to switch it around and just simply flip it. That bill, that proposal failed pretty soundly. We had a very good advocate in the legislature at that time. Actually, I don't know that he was an advocate so much as he didn't tolerate hypocrisy. And so it was pretty clear to him, and he moved on that, introducing, ironically, 21 amendments to that bill to make a point yet again. In 2006, then, the Attorney General, later that spring, after that law was attempted to be passed, one of the legislators asked for an attorney general's opinion, and the opinion was released, and the attorney general said that they could be determined to be either beer or distilled spirits, that our law was ambiguous. So, but one or the other was fine, and so, of course, the commission was going to hold fast at this point with the industry pressure and use the distilled spirits definition. We went on to collect more than 900 resolutions of support across the state, including 50 or more resolutions of support from municipalities. And for those cities and counties, they had to actually take a vote to support that resolution, so it was very much a formal process on their end. And that was really substantial support across the state. I think what I want to make certain that everyone understands is that we, every step along the way and every part of the process, we really did attempt to use the system that was in place and the process and protocol that was identified so that we weren't, if you will, outing our regulatory body or others for not doing the right thing without having been involved in the discussion from the beginning, urging every step of the way that we follow the law and do it in a way that protected the community and the public's health at the same time. That was not going to be our commission continued in its process of using the distilled spirits standard or definition, now using the federal guideline as a guise that that they were going to stand behind. One of the considerations we had is it's rare for states to opt for preemption from the federal level, but in this case, we were pretty ready to do that. So in October of 2006, we found a friendly partner at the Creighton University Law School, and that legal clinic filed for us pro bono our first lawsuit. And Project Extra Mile was the only plaintiff in addition to a parent taxpayer, a mom of two daughters. We were very quickly determined to have standing in that case. The court came back and ruled and ordered the Liquor Control Commission to commence the rulemaking process, finding first that the commission had not even used its own rulemaking process outlined in the Administrative Procedures Act. They did hold that hearing. We were able to move that hearing from the regular hearing room over to the Capitol. More than 100 people showed up at that hearing, which was really well done, but very shortly after that, the commission ruled again to have Alka Pops serve as in Nebraska as a beer instead of distilled spirits. Clearly, we needed to move beyond that because we were not getting anywhere with the process there. We had a second attorney, actually, because the attorney from Creighton moved out of state. And so in September of 2009, we found another pro bono attorney, a very respected man in the state, and filed our second lawsuit. This time we filed the lawsuit with the parent still in place, the Public Health Association of Nebraska, which are the public health entities across the state, and then a prevention partner also joined in with us. I think one of the pieces that's a little bit relevant here is knowing that when we first talked with the parent and explained the issue to her many years ago when we were in this very beginning process and asked whether or not this was something that she thought might be something she was interested in. She was pretty involved, not in our organization so much, but certainly in the issues. And she listened very carefully and stepped back and just very briefly said, "I have only one question." She's a very thoughtful, very intellectual, very conscientious person. And she said her only question was, why would she not do this? And I didn't have an answer for that, so she moved forward. Again, the important piece here is that we've had new partners join us in that second lawsuit. Next slide. Just this February 14th, which we thought it was probably relevant that it was on Valentine's Day, it was a sweet deal. The District Court of Lancaster County ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, Project Extra Mile, the Public Health Association, parent, and other prevention partner, and ruled in our favor. Now, it's, again, probably noteworthy, I haven't mentioned, probably small dollars for some states, but we lose approximately $2 million a year in tax revenue for the misclassification of the products. So over the period of time that they've been in our state, it's about more than $20 million we've lost in tax revenue. So certainly significant in these economic times. Really, just a couple of days ago and barely a week following that, our Attorney General appealed the court's decision. And I think one of the interesting pieces of the appeal, there are several pieces that are interesting. We know that Diageo's was pushing hard to get our state to appeal. We also know that the only beneficiary of the appeal, if it's successful, is the alcohol industry because they will have less taxes to pay. Otherwise, citizens in the state and certainly our children don't benefit. But the interesting piece beyond that is that if you remember back a few years earlier, our attorney general had an opinion at the request of a senator. If you remember, his opinion was that our law was ambiguous, that they could be identified as either beer or distilled spirits. What he didn't say in that opinion years earlier was what we now know, and that is that he really preferred them to be defined as beer, because that's what his appeal is based on. So that's where we're at on it, Aiden. And, I think from a community perspective in terms of what communities can do, you know, I would just encourage local efforts to make certain that they are engaging in the process, not just in the kind of traditional realm that we often think, but it's important to be involved in the regulatory process and the meeting out of penalties and the rulemaking process, because it's not just on these larger issues that we see rulemaking have some relevance, but it's on what we might think are kind of obscure areas, but they really do have, it does have some relevance. And so to be involved and engaged and know what that process is like and to make certain that you use the process and the procedures in place, doing it respectfully, professionally, but knowing that nonetheless in being engaged in that manner, you will still have questions come your way and certainly your organization question as to what one is doing because of that involvement. But ultimately, as our lawsuit and our effort all along the way was always about the kids and knowing full well that those products were targeted kids and consumed in large measure by kids. And as someone who was aware of that, an organization aware of it, we didn't feel like we could sit by and ignore that information and still do our jobs with integrity. So thanks, Aiden. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Diane, and thanks for telling us about the power of the community to make a real difference in describing this journey, which was very long and took quite a bit of time, but clearly is encouraging for people who are willing to take that on. And I will have some questions for you later about that.
Okay.
Our third speaker is Mr. Steve Schmidt, who represents the National Alcohol Beverage Control Association, whose member states and counties are engaged in the regulation and sale of alcohol beverages to the public. So I'd like to welcome you, Steve. Thanks for joining our conversation on this most important topic. And I think everyone is going to be very interested to hear how what your association feels about this issue and maybe some of the things that you're engaged in.
Yeah, thanks, Aiden. And let me just add my comments to both what Michelle and Diane said, and that I do think that community and advocacy and groups outside of government play a critical role, I think, in helping to identify the kind of threats that, I think alcoholic energy drinks posed and I think other products pose in the market today. So I really appreciate being on the panel with them. Has the first slide come up yet for me?
It is up.
Okay, I might be having a little bit of an internet problem, but that's okay. Let me just go right to the slide that says, who is NABCA? Again, just by way of a real quick definition, NABCA represents or works with the 19 jurisdictions or considered controlled jurisdictions, which means these are states that have decided, then they decide right after Prohibition, that they were going to take on the role of some part of the sales or distribution cycle because they felt that was the best way to help protect the public. And these states, by the way, have continued to be control states to this day. And you will see in a moment why that is a very important role or a very important aspect to how these products were dealt with in these individual states. But let me go to the next slide and some of the early concern in action. I want to kind of again, thank Michelle and Diane. I think they handled the history, especially Michelle, well on this issue. But there were some things going on fairly early on that were of significant concern to our state, I think to other regulators and to our board. And very early on, in fact, probably back in the early part of this, the early part of the first decade of the century, we were looking at the issue of Red Bull and vodka being mixed and the concern about energy products being mixed with beverage alcohol at that point being mixed typically on-premise or at your home. And then, of course, came along the malt beverages. I'm not going to go into what occurred with that, but I think that the AG actions were really critical, and I believe they continue to be really critical today. AGs had not necessarily up until the late 90s, early 2000s, really been very involved with alcohol issues. They didn't see it as their purview. They believed that it was the ABC's purview or somebody else. And when they started to look at it from the perspective of consumer protection, I think that was an important turning point, at least in getting them on board and having them become key players. And in it's the AGs and the regulators work closely together. But I do want to, again, emphasize what Michelle emphasized, that they were continue to be a key player. But some of the states early on were tracking some of these early companies. In Oregon, they had begun to investigate some of the products that were actually being developed out of their own state and keeping a close eye on it. There were other states that were also very concerned and had begun to even include, and again, keep in mind that our early discussions were about what was going on premise where products are being mixed and or outside of on-premise and in-home. And as a result, we sought to try to have states really look at this and make sure they included it in their server-seller education curriculums. And then some states started, I think, to see the environment, and this was, as Diane mentioned, really related to, and really alcoholic energy drinks are clearly a subcategory of the alcohol pops phenomenon. And what we saw in Utah was they're saying that, look, we just can't accept this. If we're going to have it, it's going to go through the state system, which really ends up increasing the price so much that there really isn't a market for these products. Montana was very concerned specifically with the issue of alcohol or with energy drink ingredients that were being infused into beverage alcohol products, and what they passed a rule that said, you can't sell these in our state either without it going through the state system if it includes any alcohol, if it includes any energy ingredients at all. So they really essentially, significantly reduced the market because the prices were so much higher and the access was what's much more limited. And then we had some states that were looking and saying, well, we really need to make sure we inform the public, we inform licensees. So Virginia, for example, created a formal consumer education program, which also included education to licensees. But all along, NABCA was really tracking this issue both via news. Well, we were working with AGs. We were talking with groups like the Marin Institute and others around the country and trying to get a handle on what they were seeing in their jurisdictions, what actions they were taking, in a lot of ways to make certain that our regulators understood or our members understood this was being taken very, very seriously. Many of our members were already doing that, and there are others that were doing it. But, as I think Diane and Michelle, said, that sometimes regulators are going to have different perspectives on these issues. They're in a position where they are trying to balance many different aspects, and they are in close communication with the industry. They are in close communication with other government entities and the marketplace. And there are times when they are slow to the table. There are other times when they're ahead of everybody else to the table because they see a trend that's coming or they stay tuned in. But for the most part, all we're keeping an eye and really we're concerned. Let me go to the next slide because it is an example of the Virginia Consumer Education Program. And then this was something really that came out of a presentation that we had asked Mary Claire O'Brien and a couple of deputy AGs to have with our board of directors. And as a result, some of the heads of these agencies were, I think had a chance to review the research, review what was going on behaviorally with these issues, and went back to their own states. And Virginia is a good example and really began to implement initiatives to try to certainly increase the awareness of the public around the issue. Let me go to the next slide. NABCA itself as an organization, was also reaching out to the federal agencies that were, we believed, had a role to play. The TTB, the FTC, the Tax and Trade Bureau, the Department of Treasury, which oversees the National Alcohol Act, the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, because we believe that the products were certainly deceptive, both in how they were being presented as well as in their danger. And then the FDA, who also had jurisdiction in looking at this as an additive. And this was really a point driven home to us by the AGs themselves. So as an organization, we took we passed a resolution in 2009, although this was the second resolution. We actually had also addressed this issue 3 years earlier, but at that point it was more around the mixing of the products than it was the actual products that were being manufactured with both energy ingredients and alcohol as well. So this is just to give you a little bit of a sense for some of what was going on early on in the concern. Let me go to the next slide. The concern, obviously, I really began to escalate. And I would say that there were some things going on that we saw in the marketplace that certainly we believe really escalated. And it was this increasing the alcohol content of the products and the serving sizes. When these products first hit the market, and Michelle referenced, AB, Anheuser-Busch, and Miller's involvement early on, these were products that at that point had 6% alcohol by volume. It was not long as these younger and smaller companies began to get into the market, I think they began to see a niche for higher alcohol content in these products. So, what we saw ultimately were products that, had now topped out at 12%. And they also saw a great idea in increasing the can size. And what's interesting about that is that is an issue, as I think both Michelle and Diane have referenced, still exists today. Whether or not you have energy ingredients in a product, this has now become, these 24-ounce cans have almost become a standard. And the fact of the matter is, especially with them being in cans where they're, it's a pop top, it's hard to view them as anything else other than single serve. And this is something, again, I know our organization and several regulators have been having conversations with AGs and the TTB and FDA or FTC over, because again, I think it is a product that, is something very different, than we have had to deal with or states have had to deal with in the past. There had already been a great deal of attention from groups like Diane's and from Michelle's that were focused on this, but surprisingly, and I'll go back only 2 years ago, surprisingly when we raised this issue with other prevention and community groups, especially locally, they were not quite as in tune to the issue. I think as the media reports began to ratchet up, they became more involved. I think they were beginning to see the information that was being put out by groups around the country, but they really did not see it was not an issue that was very high on many, many local radars at that point, 2 years ago. And again, at that point, we didn't have 12% alcohol by volume in these products, but they were ticking up quickly. And then, as Michelle said, we really did have what I think were the game-changing media reports that finally, I think, got legislators and regulators and governors and others to take notice. And those were the activities that were going on college campuses. And the fact of the matter is that we even had college campuses that began to ban these products themselves. And I think that really helped to give more more notice to this issue. The other thing that was interesting we were seeing at this point, I want to make note of this because I think this is a group that it is important to, when I talk about what I think the future issues are, this is a group that's important. It's the medical community. We began to get reports out of emergency rooms that said, look, we ended up having some very highly intoxicated students this past weekend. When we did a little bit of investigation, we find out that apparently these certain products were popping up, Four Loko and juice and products similar to that. And they were willing to certainly go on record with reporters and that type of thing and talk about these experiences. And that was, I think, an important part of the media attention that was going on at that time. Let me go to the next slide. Again, right on the heels of all this, there were some continued actions. Just real quickly, I'll note them. Products not being listed. This had already begun in the control states, and this is what I meant, that the control states have one interesting aspect to them. And when it comes to distilled spirits especially, and in several of them wine, they have the ability to keep certain products off the shelves. And there were several states that had already taken the position they would not allow distilled spirits on shelves in their state-owned stores that included energy ingredients. So there were some of those actions taking place. Washington State, as early as 3-4 years ago, gave notice to the industry, to the distilled spirits industry, that they wanted no marketing materials in their stores that talked about the combining of energy drinks and alcohol. Michigan was, you know, very active with a local advocacy group there that was working closely with the ABC, but really the local group was working very hard to try to bring this issue to Michigan's attention. And early on, they called for label changes. They ultimately ended up moving in that direction in August and September of 2010. By that time, quite frankly, there had been some it was pretty obvious that there was going to be probably some action taken by a federal agency on these products as the media attention and had grown. And there had been continued communication, again, by regulators and our agencies with those with the TTB and the FTC and FDA. And then as the days wound down to November 14th, which was the day that or November 17th, I guess, which was the day that the FDA announced their action to ban these certain products, states had already begun to either ban or to pull off the shelves or to ask for voluntary requests, as Pennsylvania had done, to try to get these products off the shelves. Let me move to the last of my slides. I think, though, that this brings us to where are we today or what's next. And the one thing that I would say, and I want to start with it, it's the third one, is communication. And you heard of what I think are excellent examples already from the first two speakers of the kind of communication that prevention and public health groups must have with regulators. Very often regulators are not as aware of what is of concern to public health under communities as you would hope they would be. Some are, but many are not. And unless you are speaking with them, unless you have an ongoing communication with them, unless you have, as I think Diane even at times referred to it, as a respect for each other, that we can agree to disagree, or we can be disagree without being disagreeable, that is a critical relationship to have. They play an important role in getting messages to the industry. They play an important role with legislatures in letting them know what actions need to be taken. And they are a key player, and especially in the control jurisdictions where they have a great deal of interaction with the industry because they are involved in some part of the sales process of products. But they certainly are someone that you want to cultivate and work with. And moving up that list, let me talk about legislation and regulation. Even though I think we've seen some very positive progress on this issue, I think Diane and Michelle were absolutely right. Nothing should surprise us today. I just saw some of the news reports about in the last month on a new category of soft drink called that are meant to relax you. I think if you see things in the non-alcohol market that look like they are catching fire, and if it would be a legal way to somehow make an alcohol product out of it, I would tell you that the beverage alcohol industry certainly is interested in trying to capture niche markets. What drives the beverage alcohol industry a lot is, and this is important to understand, is shareholder wealth. So they are always looking to make certain that they are on the cutting edge, that they are, you know, putting products out there that the consumer wants. And I think that that's what ultimately led to the, you know, the energy drink and the alcohol, you know, being mixed together and then ultimately into products. It was something that there was a view that the consumers wanted, regardless of what the potential danger was. So I think it's important to note that, you know, there's still a lot to be done. I think that brings me to that product surveillance issue. I think as you learn of things, I think you need to let your statewide groups know. You need to let organizations like ours know about it. We track news daily. We're typically on top of trends and on issues that are taking place, but it's very important to have that communication. I think to be ongoing product surveillance, which, by the way, I think is not only a function of community groups, but it's a function of enforcement. It's a function of the medical community. It's a function of anybody that should be interested or concerned about these kinds of beverage alcohol issues. And then I think any time that you have a chance to weigh in on legislation and regulation, it's critically important to do that. So I'm going to end my remarks here because I know we want to have some time for questions.
Well, thank you, Steve, for a very insightful perspective on some of these issues from an association who's tremendously vested in the safety and welfare of all the citizens in the states that you represent, as well as around the country. And we have about 12 minutes for questions. So, Nicole, can you once again remind our audience how they can get their questions in?
Certainly. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone keypad at this time.
And with that, Nicole, do we have any anyone who's lined up in there ready to get their question out?
Not at this time.
Okay. Well, let me, if I can take a moment to start the questioning off, and I will ask our faculty if you could kind of keep your answers as brief as you can without not answering the question. But we spoke about, and Diane, you mentioned about being engaged, and I guess my question is the process. Alcohol laws are a lot like a patchwork quilt. It takes quite a while to kind of understand that system. Looking at some of the things that are out there, the decisions, as Steve mentioned, what's going on? We have alcohol-infused chocolate milk. We have whipped cream now that has alcohol in it, ice cream and sorbets. There's even a vodka out there now that markets itself by having protein in it and as an attractive quality. So where do people go to get this type of knowledge? Where do they go to learn the system?
Don't go to law school.
They go to law school.
No, don't go to law school.
Well, I guess I would say, Aiden, the only way that I know is to ask literally anyone and everyone any question you might have. And thinking of the smartest people around you, the people who have kind of the experience and the expertise, and just question them, kind of learn at the knee of someone who knows. I remember in my early days talking to a prosecutor who was very informed, remains a very good ally just in terms of the work generally, and it's just brilliant. And it's brainstorming with people who either are connected directly or indirectly. And you're just gathering more information as you go. It's really the only way. It gives you the biggest breadth of knowledge that you're going to get. There isn't a one-stop shop. I guess if I could plug certainly the Pyre Center's training, it is helpful to be able to kind of have some of hands-on walkthrough. Here's the process and here's how it works in a more technical assistance way. But you really have to have someone that you're able to call, I mean, frankly, because you have those moments. And there's a lot of strategizing and nuances of a situation that are different for everyone.
Well, with that, Nicole, do we thank you
can
for
I,
that?
Can I jump in real quick?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I think you're absolutely right that alcohol policy and laws tend to be intimidating to a lot of people, and that's what gives the alcohol industry a huge advantage. They have, of course, their lobbyists, their lawyers in the state capitals all over the country every single day not only understanding the law, but actually writing the laws. And so I agree with Diane, of course, you know, we need to be asking questions at every opportunity. I would specifically suggest asking your government officials, not state legislators. Unfortunately, legislators are often the last ones to understand alcohol law, but your state regulators. You know, I've learned a lot from asking the general counsel at our ABC specific questions. If you can find friendly members of industry, they are actually a wealth of information. I've learned a lot from asking people in industry to explain the law to me. Unfortunately, I learned nothing about alcohol law in law school. There are lawyers in the field, of course, Jim Mosier, who taught me everything I know, is a tremendous resource, and he works with other lawyers. Unfortunately, there's a few of us in this field, but there are people out there, you know, people knowledgeable like Dan, other states as well. Just call on the resources that are out there, and that is, of course, a role that we want to play here at Marin Institute as well.
Yeah, I would, Michelle, just to kind of double up on that, absolutely talk to your regulators. Ask them all sorts of questions. It's the only way you learn. And the other piece is we have a number of retailers, particularly, who are friendly to us, but friendly very privately, because they risk a bit of their reputation if they hang with us, I guess. And so they will provide information to us periodically. It's cultivating those relationships.
Well, thank you for those insightful remarks. Nicole, do we have anyone that's lined up for a question?
Yes, we do. Mary Hill, your line is open.
Okay.
Well, Mary Hill, how are you? Welcome.
Well, I'm fine, Bill.
What is your question?
Ignore my Texas slang, but here, I put it on the board here. You know, we have really attracted lots of news, the NBA, National Basketball Association, with the young athletes who walked in the service station, got their energy drink that then were suspended because it had drugs involved. I'm wondering if we're seeing some concern from what really concerned me was our high school and college athletic programs. Are they doing anything about this? And maybe Steve answered it by saying that we're going to look at the labels and mandate what's in it. I know the professional team near me, they're having their trainers look at everything, even going to the labs of where drinks and supplements are being processed. So I don't know. Is there anything going on from that? Because that's a big area.
Thanks for your question, Mary. Panel, would you like to take a crack at Mary's question?
Well, this is Steve. I mean, what I will say, Mary, is we have not, I mean, from our perspective, I think there around the country, there is certainly some colleges and some high schools that are very aware of this. But I have to tell you that I continue to be a bit concerned that there does not seem to be the level of awareness around energy drinks in and of themselves, but as they're mixed with alcohol, I have not seen as much as I would have expected at the college level, especially given some of the media that occurred late last year and earlier this year. I can't think of a lot of activity in this area at this point.
Well, I'd like to take this moment to also plug you've heard Dr. Mary Claire O'Brien referenced by a number of our speakers, and there is an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association dated January 26, 2011, entitled "The High Risk of Energy Drinks," and she and her colleague, Dr. Aria, do a nice job of laying out some of these issues. So I'd encourage you to take a visit to JAMA's website and possibly get access to this. Nicole, do we have other questions?
Not at this time.
Well, with that, I think there was one question that was in the chat box, which was speaking to the arguments around the loss of tax revenues from reclassifying or classifying Alco-Pops as beer. Steve, you see a kind of a broader issue with the legislatures that you deal with in your control states. How are states looking at some of those issues?
Well, I will say that it's been more of this these high alcohol content drinks, whether or not they have a high alcohol content brewed products, whether or not they have caffeine or energy drinks, energy products in them or not, there is an increasing concern that why would we treat beer differently if the alcohol content is the same as a bottle of wine or even a lower level distilled spirits. And there is a significant tax advantage for beer in all the states. Maybe minus one, but for the most part, it is a discussion that we know is going on. We suspect it will heat up in the next, especially with the budgets where they're at right now, and you hear a lot of discussions about tax increases. But I think in relationship to the overall alcohol market, this is an issue that also plays into labeling as well. And how does alcohol by volume content issues, labels, how should it be labeled? Should it be labeled? But I think that the tax discussion is one that is very important to regulators and very important to legislatures. And I'm sure you'll have examples throughout the country where this is going to come up in the next few years.
I think the question was specifically about how someone in a state might be able to estimate what the potential loss is. And there's two parts really to the answer. One is you have to be in a state where that would actually be the case. In other words, that your state is misclassifying the beverages now because it's different in each state depending on the law. And secondly, that is an economic estimate that we've done in California, and it's something we know how to do at Merton Institute, and we'd be happy to help anyone who's in a state where that makes sense to take a look at. So the answer to that is contact me.
I will just say very quickly, Aidan, we were very fortunate that back in 2003 our Liquor Control Commission staff was on record in the newspaper indicating the kind of tax revenue loss that we had. So we've continued to use that figure, and if it's inaccurate, I'm guessing they'll let us know. My guess is it's more, which is why they're not letting us know.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I think this conversation can go on for a much longer period of time, but it is indeed a pleasure for PIRE to bring you experts from the Marin Institute and the Project Extra Mile and NABCA. So as we wind up our call, I'd like to, on behalf of OJJDP and the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, I'd like to thank our guests, Attorney Michelle Simon, our good friend from Project Extra Mile, Diane Reby, and Mr. Steve Schmidt from the National Alcohol Beverage Control Association, for speaking today and for our audience for calling in. If you have additional questions related to this call, please call or send us an email at udetc@udetc.org, and we'll be happy to provide answers or connect you to the resources that can help you. And as you've heard from Michelle and from Diane and Steve, they are resources that are readily available and willing to help you. And as we said earlier, this presentation has been recorded, so for those of you who would like to obtain a copy of the presentation, you can download this and our past presentations from our website at udetc.org. We'd like you to mark your calendar for our next presentation, which is scheduled for March 24th, that will discuss the important issues around managing alcohol at special events. And a reminder that the views expressed here today are not necessarily the views of OJJDP or the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, and are solely those of the presenters and audience participants of our call. In closing, we'd like to remind you that our project is a resource for your use, and we're always available to provide support in a variety of ways. And we encourage you to call our toll-free number, which is 877-335-1287, or visit us at the web, which is underagedrinkingenforcementtrainingcenter.org, for more information. And we'd like to remind you that the 13th Annual National Leadership Conference will be held this year in August, and you will be receiving details on the conference in the weeks ahead. As in years past, this is the premier conference for those who are interested in the area of underage alcohol and who desire to participate in some wonderful training sessions. So we ask you to visit our conference website as soon as it's up at udetc.org and register for what promises to be a wonderful conference experience for both young and old. So thank you for taking the time to join us today. We look forward to getting you on a future call. And again, if we can do anything for you, please let us know. Thank you, and have a great day.